I'm really privileged to be part of this panel and to speak on the issue of Iranian women and the needed policy on Iran in Washington. You know, there was a time in my life when I kind of looked around and I realized every woman close to me was touched by Islamic fundamentalism and the Iranian regime. Starting with my mother, who was a political activist. She was arrested by the Iranian regime in the 1980s, and incidentally, she was actually diagnosed at the time with cancer while she was in prison. And then on to my sister, who was a student activist in the 1980s, and she was also in prison, and she was arrested at age 14, and really suffered from unspeakable torture, as well as really nearly losing her life, just like many other teenagers who lost their lives, young women who lost their lives under this brutal regime in Iran. And if you fast forward that to 1990s, when I actually adopted my daughter, I realized that she too was victimized by the Iranian regime. Her natural father was killed by Tehran's regime during the 1988 massacre of the political prisoners. In the summer of 1988, Khomeini decided to kill all the political prisoners, and about 30,000, both men and women, were executed by the regime in Tehran. So I really want to use this personal account in as a window to the resistance of Iranian women against fundamentalism, and really talk more about the linkage between their resistance and political voice of leadership and empowerment of women in my homeland. And let me just read a report to you from Time magazine. Dr. Hughes talked about how important it is to talk about terror at home. And I actually just recently came across an article by Time magazine, which was published in 1981, July 1981. The title of the article was "Terror in the Name of God. The Mullahs Impose Their Will with Vengeance." And it starts off with the story about 12 women, 12 young women. Reading from the article, it says, their crime was to take part in a demonstration. The Islamic judge who sentenced them, Ayatollah Mohammadi Gilani, did not even know their name. The 12 girls, the oldest was 18 and the others under 16, refused to identify themselves in court. When Gilani asked their names, each turned and replied, "Mujahid." Mujahid is a member of the Mujahideen Khalq organization that was just recently mentioned by Dr. Hughes and Claire Lopez. To the question of child of, each replied, "The Iranian people." To the Gilani solved the problem of identifying the girls by having them photographed, and then he consigned them to a firing squad. Islamic guards led the dozen girls to the courtyard of Evin prison, the notorious Evin prison, the same prison that Zahra Kazemi was killed and Canadian photojournalist was killed just a few years ago. The oldest girl was wearing a black chador, a Muslim veil. The others wore dark headscarves. As the guards began to blindfold them, the girls started chanting, "Death to fascism, death to Khomeini." In answer, the guards in prison attended, watched the spectacle, began to their own chant and said, "Allahu Akbar," which means God is great. And then the rifles rolled. 3 days later, the clergy-controlled newspaper, Ittilaat, printed the girls' picture with a terse message asking the parents to call for the bodies. The parents should bring the papers, the paper said, birth certificate bearing the girls' pictures. At a press conference, Gilani defended his sentencing and says it was according to Islamic rules. He said, "A 9-year-old girl is a mature woman, so there is no difference for us between a 9-year-old girl and a 4-year-old man." There are countless, countless cases of such atrocities in Iran against women. But what I want to talk about today, in fact, actually, I must say, since Ahmadinejad took office in the summer, violence against women have been on the rise. I was just going through some of the material that our host has put together today, and I ask you to look at that material. If you look at the rates of violence against women starting in December, in October of last year, in January of last year, you will see women are being sentenced to execution, women are being publicly hanged, women are being stoned to death, or at least sentenced for stoning. So we really have to focus on, as Dr. Hughes have said, the nature of gender apartheid in Iran, and understand why, as you eloquently explained, why Islamic fundamentalists loathe women. In Iran's case, and unfortunately we see it in recent months and recent years in Iraq, as Niran talked about, women are the prime victim of violence in both private and public spheres. Publicly, they are treated as second-class citizens, and privately, they enjoy no rights or protection of law. So when we're dealing with a state-sponsored of violence, desperation, depression, and lack of hope, some women are actually driving themselves to committing suicide. And just to kind of share with you some of the facts and figures, suicide rate in Iran is among the highest in the world. But 75% of the suicide rates in Iran are women. And 81% of those women are between the age 15 to 31 years old. It is truly a heartbreaking fact. And yes, Iranian women are paying a very, very heavy price. But one can talk hours about various forms of violence against women and really capture what's happening to women of my homeland. But what I want to focus on today is to share with you how the political change in Iran have brought a fundamental change in the way women are viewing their social, political, and strategies for empowerment. So let me go back to the whole issue and the linkage between women's resistance to Islamic fundamentalism and their political voice. It is very simple. Unless Iranian women did not believe in their political voice and agenda, they would have not been a resistance to Islamic fundamentalism. In other words, from the moment Iranian women reject Islamic fundamentalism oppression, whether it's at home or in the streets or against the government, they have become political. So it's important to recognize that first, women's struggle in Iran is political in nature. We must recognize that. Second, Iranian women are struggling for their rights on many different fronts, whether it's social, economic, or political. Third, political voice of women speaks to the rejection of Islamic fundamentalism and not against Islam. It's very, very important that we recognize that. We must recognize Islam is not at fault. It is, in fact, Iranian women consider the ruling regime in Tehran as the worst enemy of Islam. So, moving on to the fourth, political agenda of women in Iran is to replace Tehran's fundamentalist regime with a secular republic where there is a clear separation of church and state. So given all this, you may ask how Iranian women plan to achieve and realize such political agenda. I do agree with our host today, Ms. Kazerunian, that because of the nuclear standoff with Tehran, currently the world community is actually desperate to defeat Iranians' danger, the danger by the Iranian regime. But the answer is not an Iraqi style and war on Iran. What we're asking is also not to appease the Iranian regime. The status quo is no longer an answer. And instead, we must adopt a multi-track strategy towards Tehran's fundamentalist regime. And by that I mean a path that would be working towards a development of a Tehran policy that would represent a rejection of this regime in its entirety. At the same time, couple it with the collective effort of the international community engineered specifically to isolate and eventually eliminate the root cause of the Tehran problem. Very much similar to the South African model, to isolate, the isolation of the apartheid regime in that country worked, and it really brought that regime down, and the same strategy could work for Iran. I sincerely hope that the next step, now that there is a talk of sanctions on Iran, and Iran was reported to the UN Security Council. The next step is for the countries who are focused on Iran's nuclear issue to actually push for sanctions. But more importantly, Washington, Paris, London, and Berlin, the EU3, must complement the sanctions with a robust Tehran policy that is geared in support of the Iranian people and women's political agenda. And such policies, in my opinion, includes three main important elements. The first one is we must tighten and codify the existing U.S. sanctions, bar any subsidiaries of the U.S. companies from doing business in Iran, cut foreign aid, and countries that have business investing in Iran. Publicly and privately criticize the government, or those governments who are engaged in oil, arms, technological, or diplomatic relations with Iran. More than 350 members of U.S. Congress have called for this sanction, and I really hope that they pick up the ball on that and really push for the administration to adopt this as a U.S. official policy on Iran. The second issue that I want to bring up, and it was also mentioned by previous speakers, Dr. Hughes talked about those groups, as well as Claire Lopez. In my opinion, open dialogue with Iran's main opposition groups, particularly those led by women, it's very, very important. We must isolate the regime by cutting all private talks. And we know U.S. still has private talks with Iranian regime, but all those talks must be cut off. And U.S. must show its political preference in having talks with opposition. Specific steps in this area must include the lifting of the political and the legal ban on the National Council of Resistance of Iran, NCRI, and Mojahideen-e-Khalq, MEK. These groups, both led by women, have raised international awareness on Tehran's human rights record since the 1980s, terrorism and regional interference along with missile technologies since the 1990s, and the illegal nuclear activities in recent years. So it behooves Washington to have open dialogue with such influential opposition groups, and quite honestly, not to know what Iran's main opposition group, the NCRI and the MEK, is thinking and doing is not only bad diplomacy, but it's also foolish politics. But an ability to maintain an active network inside and outside of Iran, one can easily measure the National Council of Resistance of Iran or the Mujahideen-e-Khalq effectiveness and seriousness in changing the regime in Tehran. I know Claire's organization have done some assessment in that area. Iran Policy Committee actually conducted an 8-month study of Tehran's fear of its opposition, which placed the MEK at the highest rating among all the other groups. So Iranian regime really does fear this group very much. So members of Congress, European parliamentary members, are routinely hold talks and engage with representatives of the NCRI and the MEK. The administration officials could certainly benefit from these similar engagements and learn more about women's political agenda and leadership in the resistance movement in Iran. Third, and Tehran's growing influence in Iraq. We just heard from Iran how Iranian regime is by spending a lot of money and expanding its network in Iraq. It's trying to influence the situation there. We must end that growing influence and encourage and empower progressive and anti-fundamentalist forces in Iraq, including Shiite, Sunni, Kurdish, and any other Iraqi religious or ethnic groupings that are networked with the Iranian anti-fundamentalist group, namely the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. Early this year, more than 12,000 Iraqi jurists and lawyers declared and emphasized a nationwide support for the Mujahideen-e-Khalq and their 4 years of struggle against two dictatorships. For the sake of stability, peace, and security in the region, Tehran's role must end in Iraq. As an Iraqi political expert, Dr. Rashid Al-Jaburi, who recently outlined in his Washington Times op-ed piece, he says, the Iranians like to portray Iraqi Shiites as seeking an Iranian-style regime. However, developments in the last 2 years, particularly in the last 10 months, must be seen as an organized bid to spread Iran's influence in Iraq by taking advantage of a gap in U.S. policy and political imbalance in Iraq. The Iranian regime has decided that its progress in meddling in Iraqi affairs has paralyzed and neutralized international community. So as you see, strategically and tactically, empowering the anti-fundamentalist coalition in Iraq will really serve as a better buffer against Tehran's increasing influence, and literally it will save lives of millions of Iraqi women, because we just heard from Iran how women are fearing their lives by walking in the street, whether it's in Najaf, Karbala, or Baghdad. They have to cover themselves in order to be secure in the streets. So you've heard about the situation in Iraq. You've heard about the situation in Iraq. You've heard about the steps that Washington can take in order to create conditions to bring about meaningful change that would be in support of the Iranian agenda for democracy and Iraqi agenda for actually establishing a very healthy democracy. But there's literally little time for action. Having policies aligned with rhetorics is indeed what's needed today. If we do that, then we could get countries like Russia, India, China, those countries who are dragging their feet and cutting their ties off with the Iranian regime, they will be urged to join. So once coupled, once we have an international path achieved in terms of isolating regime and imposing sanction on the Tehran's regime, as well as its very clear policy, as I outlined, in Washington and other various capitals in Europe, you couple that with the organized network of the National Council of Resistance and the Mujahideen-e-Khalq inside of Iran and outside of Iran, the democracy movement will ultimately bring the regime down faster than we might think. So in short, I really want to summarize and say women's strategy and Iranian solution to a Tehran problem is Iranian people can bring this regime down just as long as the governments in Washington, Paris, London, and Berlin are serious about closing the door on the Iranian regime. Thank you very much.